I have a dream.
One small step.
How many we say?
The wall must go.
Diana, Princess of Wales.
Crashed into the World Trade Center.
Winner is Sydney.
This week in history.
Look, you've probably heard of Charing Cross in London. What about Waltham Cross? Both of these locations in England take their name not from a crossroads, as you might expect, but because of what might be one of the most romantic gestures in English history. They got their name from a series of elaborate stone crosses built in the 13th century by a mourning husband in honour of his dead wife. The husband was King Edward I of England and his wife was Eleanor of Castile. And it was this week in history, on November the 28th, 1290, that Eleanor died, prompting these crosses to be built at every place where her body stopped for the night on its way back to London before she eventually died in Nottinghamshire. There were 12 crosses in total, and to tell us the story of these crosses and what's happened to them over the centuries, our guest is Deca Warrington, who's long been fascinated by this story and has subsequently written a book called The Eleanor Crosses. Hello, Deca, and welcome to This Week in History.
Hello, thank you very much.
Now tell us about your fascination with this story, Deca. When did it begin?
Oh, many, many years ago. I was studying English medieval architecture in an evening class, and the Eleanor Crosses came up because not only are they this great romantic gesture, they're also very significant in terms of this period of English decorated architecture. But I got fascinated by the story behind them and why they were built and the story of the lives of Edward and Eleanor. And then I sort of sat with it for a long, long time, not knowing quite what to do with it. And eventually my research turned into my book.
Now, before we get to Edward I's romantic side, I want to talk a little bit about his tougher side, because he had one. He was a fierce warrior, indeed. Wasn't he, Deca?
Renowned
for his attacks on both Wales and Scotland. So tell us a little bit about that tougher side.
He still has quite a bad name in both Wales and Scotland. He's referred to as the Hammer of the Scots, and the Welsh really resent his programme of castle building, where he built these incredible castles known as the Ring of Steel around Snowdonia in order to impose English domination on the Welsh. And he was a very, very fierce warrior, and there were many wars and battles in Scotland, which continued under the reign of Edward's son, Edward II. So, yes, indeed, he was very much an action man and a warrior.
And he was especially tall, wasn't he, Deca?
He was. One of his nicknames was Edward Longshanks, and they actually opened his tomb during the 18th century because they wanted to check the preservation of the body, and he was measured and found to be 6'2", and possibly he even had shrunk a bit by then. And so it really is quite extraordinary, if you can imagine, for the time when people weren't, you know, as tall as they are now, indeed. So he was really exceptionally tall.
So this story about Edward I and his wife, Eleanor, it was unusual because it was very much a love story. Tell us a little bit about her and their marriage, Deca.
It was, of course, an arranged marriage. He was the son of the King of England, and she was the half-sister of the King of Castile. And there were some diplomatic issues over the rule of Gascony, which is in southwest France, to which England had a claim to. And this was a diplomatic solution to those issues. And at the time of their marriage, Edward was 15 years old and Eleanor was not quite 13. And it went on to be a very lasting and devoted relationship.
And there's a story that she once saved his life. Tell us about that.
Yes, it's a great story. It really is. One of the places that they went to on their many, many travels was on crusade to the Holy Land. This was before Edward became King of England. And they went to the city of Acre in modern day Israel, where the some soldiers of the Sultan managed to trick their way into having an audience with Edward. And he was quite alone at the time, and he was attacked and apparently stabbed with poison blades. But because of his phenomenal strength, he was able to fight them off and defeat them. And the story goes that Eleanor saved his life by sucking the poison out of his arm.
Oh.
In truth, it's much more likely that he had to go through a horrible operation to cut out the gangrenous flesh, and he did recover remarkably, because this is obviously in days of pre-antibiotics, where getting a wound like that would have been highly risky. In fact, his great uncle, Richard the Lionheart, died of a similar wound. So yes, so that's the story, which became very, very popular because of its romantic appeal in the 18th century. Unfortunately, it is a story.
Right. I've just got Edeka, I've just got a listener that sent in a comment saying that he's a direct descendant of Edward the First Longshanks through his daughter, Joan of Acre.
That's amazing.
Pablo from
Joan Baker was indeed conceived while they were in Acre, and brought back shortly after her birth, because Edward suffered this injury. And I think as soon as Eleanor was able to travel and he was fit enough to travel, they thought it was time to get home. So they made their way back to England. How fascinating.
Yes, isn't that interesting? Well, let's get back to Eleanor's death. And if you can tell me what they were doing in the north of England at the time, this week in the year 1290, what were they doing there?
Yes. Well, it's not certain, but it looks as if that they were attending a meeting of Parliament at a place called Clipstone, in the north of England. And from there, they were intending to travel further northwards to go to Scotland, where there was trouble over the succession to the throne. King Alexander III, who was Edward's brother-in-law, having died without having a clear line to succession. And so Edward, in his sort of statesmanlike role, was on his way to Scotland to give his advice on who should become the next king of Scotland. And they didn't get very far. They got as far as the village called Harby, which is about 10 miles from Lincoln, with Eleanor becoming increasingly unwell and not able to travel any further.
And what caused her eventual death?
It's thought to be something called quartan fever, which is a form of malaria that she is thought to have contracted when they were on one of their long stays in Gascony in the south of France. And in fact, not long before they'd returned to England in 1290, they'd spent the previous 2 years in Gascony, so that's quite likely. And it's quite a horrible death with these recurring episodes of illness, so she would have seemed to have been recovering and then succumbed to illness again.
Very unpleasant. You're listening to ABC Radio, and this is Nightlife with Indira Naidoo. And for our This Week in History, we're going back to the 13th century and finding out what the Eleanor Crosses were all about. It's a beautiful love story behind it as well. And with me to take us through it is Deka Warrington. She's the author of the Eleanor Crosses. Deka, so sadly, Eleanor now has passed away. Tell us about this procession that took her body back to London. Can you describe what it would have looked like for observers?
I think it would have been an incredibly impressive sight. If you imagine, for the time, most people were living in sort of very, very poor accommodation. It was very, very primitive. So this royal procession with carts all spread with rich ornate brocade and the sheer numbers of people who would have been involved, it would have been quite an amazing, impressive sight, I think.
And were they usual, these sort of processions, taking the body back?
Well, processions of the king were actually not uncommon, because at this period of when communications were so primitive, it was very important that the king travelled around his country and was seen. So there would have been royal processions go through. This idea of a funeral cortege, I think, is perhaps more unusual.
Right. And where was Eleanor eventually buried, Deka?
That's an interesting question. In fact, she had three tombs built for her. Her main one is in Westminster Abbey in London, where her funeral was held. Her innards, which would have been removed before they left on the funeral cortege on the way back to London, remained in Lincoln, and she had a tomb also in Lincoln to match the one in Westminster. And then a third heart tomb was built in Blackfriars Monastery in London. This was the Blackfriars being very close to Eleanor's heart, so it was appropriate.
Right, so three resting places.
Yes, indeed.
And was that unusual for the time?
It was not that unusual for royalty, because it was considered very prestigious to have sort of royal body parts in your church, in your cathedral.
Mm.
Yes.
All right. So, Deka, how long after Eleanor died did Edward set about building these crosses in her memory?
Well, he was very much an action man, as we've discussed, and he would have started as soon as the next building season started, after Easter in 1291. He would have cracked on with it.
And how would that have happened? I mean, would he have had to gather a sort of a posse of stonemasons? I mean, how big an endeavour would it have been to organise the building?
I think it's a massive endeavour if you consider the sort of communications of the time. He did have on call the best masons and artists of his age, and many of whom would have been sort of engaged more or less permanently on royal buildings. So he I think, would have diverted their efforts from what they were doing and got them all to concentrate on designing and building these amazing crosses.
So what was the purpose of these crosses? What did he want them to do, represent?
The most important function of these crosses, which I should perhaps say, it sounds a bit a bit dismissive, calling them crosses. They were large monuments of sort of 30 foot tall at least, with a cross at the top, arranged in sort of separate tiers, and the one upper tier with statues of the Queen around, and then heraldic decoration on the lower tier. So they were much, much more elaborate than the word cross might lend you to think. But their purpose, they were all put in sort of key places where they would have been seen by a maximum number of passers-by, for example, on crossroads. And their purpose was to elicit prayer from the people who were passing. And the idea being that they would offer prayers for Eleanor. And this was considered vitally important because Eleanor, after her death, she and everybody who died would have been sent to purgatory. And in the terms of the thinking of the time, that these prayers could mitigate your time in purgatory. So Edward would have had a very, very real idea of Eleanor suffering in real time, going through horrible punishments in purgatory to atone for her sins when alive. And he wanted to do something about that. And we are again action man Edward put that into practice by building the crosses.
Right. So these crosses, how long did they take to build? How much did they cost, Decca?
They were all built within 4 years, which is an incredible achievement. And they were also very, very expensive and elaborate. The London ones in particular, which had inlay and gilding on them. So they would have been extremely expensive. But Edward was quite an astute politician. So he made sure that the funding for these crosses came from Eleanor's own estates and not from the royal purse.
So that covered the lavish expense. Now, how many crosses were there in total?
There were 12, one for each nightly stopping place.
Right, and did they all look the same?
They did not, no. There is a sort of typical, what you imagine, an Eleanor cross form, but the ones in London were very much more elaborate. And there's one in a village called Geddington, which is just north of Northampton, which is rather different in form. It's thought that it might have been a Spanish mason who actually behind that one, which is why it looks rather different.
And Decca, the stonemasons who were engaged to build these crosses, was it seen as a real privilege, a real honour to do so?
I think it would have been, yes. And yes, and after the completion of the crosses, many of them went on to have very prestigious jobs, for example, working in Westminster Abbey on building royal tombs. So I think it was quite a mark of honour in order to be involved in the construction of the Eleanor crosses, yes.
And do we know whether people did stop and pray for Eleanor at these crosses? Did it work?
I pray that sort of lost in the mist of time. We do know that for quite a number of years after her death, that masses took place in Westminster Abbey. These are documented. So they had very elaborate masses which took place on the anniversary of her funeral, and it was a requirement that all the nobles in the land would attend one of these masses, and 100 candles would be lit around her tomb. So that is on record. It's very, very hard to say what actually took place in these crosses in rather remote parts of the country.
For This Week in History, we're learning about the Eleanor Crosses. Deka Warrington is the author of the Eleanor Crosses, and she's taking us through these very elaborate stone constructions, very large, 30 foot high, with lots of decoration on them. There were 12 of them in total at different spots where Eleanor was taken during her funeral procession. In terms of your research, Deka, do you think that Edward really was that devoted to Eleanor? That's why he built these crosses? Or was it also an opportunity to project royal power?
I'm sure that too, but I really do think that they were very, very devoted to each other. There was no need for her to accompany him on all his travels, and which she very much did. So they were more or less inseparable, apart from times when there was a civil war going on and they were both separately imprisoned. But really, nothing could keep them apart. And she went on to bear, we think, 16 children by him. So I don't think that would have happened unless they were quite devoted.
Yeah, you'd have to spend a bit of time together to get 16 children.
Exactly.
So with Eleanor gone, Deka, how did Edward spend the remaining 17 years of his life?
I think it's quite interesting that after her death, relations with the neighbouring countries of France and Scotland both deteriorated, and he was very much involved in fighting in Scotland. And my hunch is that without her sort of softening influence and words of advice, he was perhaps something of a less successful king. But he certainly remained very much in power, and he was under quite a lot of pressure to remarry, because at the time of Eleanor's death, they had five surviving children, but only one son. And of course, all the premium in those days was to have a son and heir. So he did eventually remarry, but it took 9 years when he married Princess Margaret of France. And he did go on to have three more children. Mm. But I think his heart was very much with Eleanor.
Mm. So 700 years have passed since then, Deka. What's happened to these crosses?
Of the 12, there are three remaining crosses, and they're two in Northamptonshire and one at that you mentioned in Waltham Cross. And I think it's quite interesting that they suffered a lot of damage at sort of key periods during English history. For example, during the Reformation under King Henry VIII, when England was becoming a Protestant country, anything Catholic was absolutely frowned upon, and the crosses would have suffered a lot of damage at that point. And we know that one disappeared. Some we're not certain about what happened to, but one certainly disappeared at that point. Where the most destruction happened was during the years of the Civil War of the 17th century, when Oliver Cromwell and the parliamentarians were taking charge. And at that point, it was not only Catholicism which was frowned upon, but the whole concept of royalty. So the crosses were considered highly symbolic of everything that the parliamentarians were fighting against.
So how much of the crosses, the remaining ones, are intact? What condition are they in now, Decca?
They have been heavily restored at various points. The one in Geddington is quite weather-beaten and worn, but I understand that funds are being raised to restore that one. The one at Waltham Cross, I think what you see now, there's very little remaining of the original cross, though the core would, of course, be. And the one in Hardingstone has been through several different phases of reconstruction. And in fact, there's recently been a campaign to save it, and it has been had more work done on it just recently. Which is good to know.
Yes. And in what sense, Decca, do you think that the fate of these crosses tell a story of England as a whole across that period of time?
I think it's very interesting that they tell this story of destruction and of survival, because it was really in the 18th century that antiquarianism became very, very popular, and that people were taking a bit of interest in English heritage, and the efforts were made to do something about making sure that these crosses didn't just crumble and disappear. And in fact, funds were raised to build bollards around the one at Waltham Cross, because it was on a coaching route from London to Lincolnshire, and it was suffering a lot of damage. And William Stukeley, I don't know if your listeners will know about him, but he was a famous antiquarian, and he personally raised money to build these bollards to protect the cross. So I find it very interesting in terms of survival. And then, of course, during the 19th century, there was a big movement towards the Gothic Revival, when people were interested in the crosses as architecturally interesting. And prior to that, the Gothic style was very much frowned upon and disapproved on, and it was all about classicism. But the Gothic style came back into fashion, and what you see happening is all these sort of imitation Eleanor crosses springing up all over the country. In fact, there's a very, very famous one in the city of Oxford called the Martyrs Memorial, and that it's built by George Gilbert Scott, and it really is very much based on an Eleanor Cross formation.
Right. And so today, Decca, can you go on a Eleanor Crosses trail if you're interested or a tourist?
It would take you to some places very much off the normal tourist beat, places like Dunstable. Not wishing to be unkind about Dunstable. It's not normally a place that tourists would flock to. And you can go to the Eleanor Cross Shopping Centre, which is how Eleanor is remembered in quite a lot of places now, where there's not a lot left to see, but her name lives on in the naming of places. And like there's an Eleanor Cross roundabout in Northampton.
Right.
But yes, of course, there are fascinating things to see.
So how well is the Eleanor Cross story known by Britons themselves?
I think everybody's heard of an Eleanor Cross, and they may not know exactly what their purpose was, but I think they are. There's something that kind of rings a bell for people. Oh yes, the Eleanor Crosses, without understanding too much about them.
Mm. So your fascination is obviously very, very deep. Is there another stage to this story that you want to explore?
I think not at the moment for me, but I very much hope that my book will perhaps whet people's appetites, and it does take you in. It does give you a sort of window into what's happening at different stages of English history. So I would very much hope that that would spark something in other people.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Deka, for joining us on Nightlife tonight.
Thank you.
Deka Warrington, author of The Eleanor Crosses, our This Week in History, going back to the 13th century, these 12 crosses that were built by King Edward I to mark the death of his wife, Eleanor of Castile.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.